might have done otherwise. With Saffalo dead, she had no further need for the Veilman's protection. She no longer belonged to anyone. She was her own person at last. She might have turned her horse about and ridden safely from the valley and the terrible thing that had killed Cephalo and the others. But Eritrea did not even stop to consider this. She thought only of Will, riding off without her, leaving her behind once more. Pride, stubbornness, and the strange attraction she felt for the Veilman flared within her. She could not permit him to do this to her again. Without hesitating, she went after him. So began their race to save Amberley. Will Ohmsford, riding as if he were a man possessed, quickly lost all track of where he was. Gloom and mist slipped about him as he came down off the ridgeline into the deep forest, and he could barely make out the dark shapes of the trees at either side as he whipped past them. Yet he did not slow. He could not. He heard the sound of another horse following and realized that Eritrea had come after him. He muttered a quick oath. Did he not have enough to worry about already? But there was no time to concern himself with the rover girl. He dismissed her from his thoughts and concentrated his efforts on finding the cutoff leading south. Even so, he rode right past it. If Eritrea had not called out to him, he might have kept riding east all the way to the mountains. Wheeling about in surprise, he charged back again. But now Eritrea had taken the lead, spurring her mount forward into the darkness. More familiar than he with the trail, she galloped ahead, calling for him to follow. Surprised all over again, he gave chase. It was a harrowing ride. The darkness was so thorough that even the sharp eyes of the rover girl could barely pick out the pathway as it twisted through the forest night. Several times the horses almost went down, barely springing clear of gullies and fallen logs that lay across the narrow trail. But these were rover horses, trained by the finest riders in the four lands, and they responded with a quickness and agility that brought a fierce cry from the lips of the rover girl and left the Veilman breathless. Then suddenly they were back upon the roadway that Amberley and Will had followed south to the hollows, with branches and vines slapping against them and muddied water splashing up from the deep puddles that had collected upon the trail. Without slowing, they turned south. The minutes slipped by. At last they broke from the forest onto the rim of the hollows, its black circle spread out before them like some bottomless pit in the earth. Reining in their horses sharply, they sprang to the ground, staring about at the forest gloom. Silence hung across the hollows, deep and pervasive. Will hesitated only a second, then began searching for the bushes in which he had hidden Amberley. He found them almost at once and pushed his way to their center. There was no one there. For an instant he panicked. He groped about for some sign of what might have happened to the elven girl, but there was nothing to be found. His panic increased. Where was she? He rose, backing from the bushes. Perhaps these were the wrong ones, he thought suddenly, and began to look about for others. He stopped almost at once. There were no others like them close enough to be seen. No, it was here that he had hidden her. Eritrea hurried up to him. Where is she? I don't know, he whispered, his lean face sweating. I can't find her. He regained control of himself with an effort. Reason it through, he told himself. Either she fled or the Reaper took her. If she fled, where would she go? He looked at once to the hollows. There, he decided, to Spire's Reach, or as close to it as she could get. What if she had been taken? What then? But she had not been taken, he realized, because there was no sign of a struggle. She would have fought back. She would have left him some sign. If she had fled, on the other hand, she would have been careful to leave nothing behind to show her pursuer that she had been there at all. He took a deep breath. She must have fled. But then a new thought struck him. He was assuming in all of this that Amberley had fled from the Reaper. What if it had not been the Reaper, but something that had come out of the hollows? his jaw locked in frustration. There was no way to tell. In this blackness, he could not hope to find a trail. Either he would have to wait until morning when it might be too late to help Amberlee, or he would have to use the elf stones. He was reaching for the pouch when Eritrea's hand gripped his arm sharply, causing him to jump in surprise. "Healer," she whispered. "Someone is coming." He felt his stomach knot sharply. For an instant he simply stood there, his gaze following the girl's as it turned north up the trail they had just traveled. On its shadowed ruts, something moved. Fear welled up within the veilman. His hand fumbled within his tunic and lifted free the elf stones. At his side, Eritrea snatched from her boot a wicked-looking dagger. Together they faced the approaching shadow. "Just hold on now," a familiar voice called out to them. Will looked at Eritrea and she at him. Slowly they lowered elf stones and dagger. The voice belonged to Hebel. Eritrea muttered something under her breath and moved to retrieve the horses which had strayed back into the forest. Down the trail trudged Hebel, the shaggy form of Drifter close at his heels. He wore leather woodsman's garb and carried a sack strapped across his back, a long bow and arrows over one shoulder, and a hunting knife at his waist. He moved with a peculiar hunching motion, leaning heavily on a gnarled walking stick. As he came up to them, they could see that he was spattered from head to foot with mud. "You nearly ran me down, you know," he snapped. "Look at me. If I'd been foolish enough to stand any further out on the trail than I did when I hailed you back there, I'd be covered with hoofprints as well as mud. What do you think you were doing riding about the forest like that? It's black as 6 feet under out there, and you ride about like it was broad daylight. Why didn't you stop when I called out to you, for cat's sake?" "Well, because we didn't hear you," Will answered in bewilderment. "That's because you weren't listening like you should have been." Hebel was not about to forgive them. He lurched right up to the veilman. "Took me all day to get here, all day. Without a horse, I might point out. What took you so confounded long, then? The way you were riding a minute ago, you could have been here and gone again half a dozen times." He caught sight of Eritrea as she reappeared with the horses. "What are you doing here? Where is the elfling girl? That thing didn't get her, did it?" Will started. "You know about the Reaper?"
"Reaper?
If that's what it's called, yes, I know about it. It came to my camp earlier today, just after you'd left. Looking for you, it appears now, though at the time I wasn't sure. Never really saw the thing. Just caught a glimpse. I think if I'd seen it close up, I'd be dead now."
"I think so, too," the veilman agreed. "Cephalo and the others are. It caught up with them on Whistle Ridge."
Hebel nodded soberly. "Cephalo was bound to come to that end sooner or later." He glanced at Eritrea. "Sorry, girl, but that's the truth of it." Then he turned back to Will.
"Now where's the little elfling?"
"I don't know," Will answered him. "I had to go back." He hesitated. "I had to go back for something I left behind with Cephalo. Amberlee had injured her ankle, so I hid her in some bushes. I went back a different way than I had come, or I would probably be dead as well. I found Eritrea, or she found me, I guess, and after we saw what had happened to Cephalo, we came back here as fast as we could. But now Amberlee is gone, and I can't be sure what has happened to her. I can't even be sure whether the Reaper has been here yet or is still tracking us."
"It's come and gone," Hebel told him. "Drifter and I have been tracking it while it's been tracking you. Lost the trail at the fork because the Reaper went east to Whistle Ridge while Drifter and I came south after you. Then the trail started up again, further south. Thing must have cut through the wilderness. If it could do that, it's dangerous, elfling."
"Ask Cephalo how dangerous it is," Eritrea muttered, glancing about at the forest shadows. "Healer, can we get out of here now?" Not until we find out what happened to Amberley, Will insisted. Hebel tapped his arm. Show me where you left the girl.
Will walked to the clump of bushes with Eretria, the old man, and the dog trailing after, and pointed to the opening leading in. Hebel bent down, peered inside, and whistled Drifter to him. He spoke quietly to the dog, and the animal came forward, sniffed about, then moved over to the rim of the hollows as the others watched.
He has the scent, Drifter has.
Hebel grunted with satisfaction. Drifter stopped and growled softly.
She is down in the hollows, Elfling. The Reaper is down there, too, probably still tracking her. I'd have guessed as much.
Then we have to find her right away. Will started forward. Hebel caught his arm.
No need to rush, Elfling. That's the hollows we're talking about, remember? Nothing down there but the witch sisters and the things that serve them. Anything else sets one foot in the hollows gets snatched right up. I know that from what Malinrow told me 60 years ago.
He shook his head.
By now, the girl and the thing tracking her are keeping company with one of the sisters. That, or they're dead.
Will went white.
Would the witches kill them, Hebel?
The old man seemed to think it over.
Oh, not the girl, I'd guess. Not right away. The thing they would. And don't think they couldn't, Elfling.
I don't know what to think anymore, Will replied slowly.
He gazed down into the blackness of the hollows.
I do know this much. I am going down there, and I am going to find Amberley. Right now.
He started to say something to Eretria, but the rover girl cut him short.
Don't waste your breath, healer. I'm going with you.
The way she said it left little room for argument. He glanced at Hebel.
I'm coming too, Elfling, the old man announced.
But you said yourself that no one should go into the hollows, Will pointed out. I don't understand why you're even here.
Hebel shrugged.
Because it doesn't matter where I am anymore, Elfling, and hasn't for a long time. I'm an old man. I've done in this life the things I've wanted to do, been where I wanted to go, seen what I've wanted to see. Nothing left for me now. Nothing except for maybe this one thing. I want to see what's down there in those hollows.
He shook his head ruefully.
Thought about it for 60 years, off and on. Always told myself that one day I'd find out. Like thinking about a deep pool. You always wonder what's at the bottom.
He rubbed his bearded chin.
Well, a sane man wouldn't waste his time with a thing like that. And I was a sane man when I was younger, though I guess some thought different. Now I'm tired of being sane. Tired of just thinking about going down there instead of doing it.
You made me decide.
When you first told me what you intended, I thought to persuade you otherwise, just as I'd persuaded myself. I was certain that you would lose interest quick enough when you heard what I had to say.
I was wrong. I saw that whatever it was that you were looking for was important enough that being afraid didn't matter to you.
So why should it matter so much to me, I thought.
Then after that Reaper thing passed me by and left me knowing how close I'd come to dying, I realized it didn't. All that really mattered was finding out about those hollows. So I came after you. I decided that we should go looking together.
Will understood.
Let's hope that we both find what we are looking for.
Well, maybe I can be of some help to you.
The old man shrugged.
This is Malinrow's End of the Hollows.
She might remember me, Elfling.
For an instant his thoughts wandered, then he glanced at Will.
Drifter can track for as long as it's needed.
He whistled.
Tag us down, dog. Go, boy.
Drifter disappeared over the rim of the hollows. Eretria stripped saddles and bridles from the horses and slapped them sharply to send them galloping back through the forest. Then she joined Will and the old man. In a line, they started down into the hollows.
"Won't have to rely on Drifter very long," Heebel declared firmly. "Malinro, she'll find us quick enough."
If that were so, Will found himself thinking, then he hoped that she would find Amberlee as well. Amberlee came awake in the darkness of the Hollows Forest. It was the slight swaying, jostling motion of being carried that awoke her, and for an instant she panicked. Gnarled fingers held her fast, locked tightly about her arms and legs, her body, even her neck and head. Fingers so rough they felt as if they were made of wood. Her first reaction was to want to break free, but she resisted it with a desperate effort and forced herself to remain still. Whatever had her did not yet know she was awake. If she were to have any advantage at all, it lay in this. For the moment, at least, she must continue to feign sleep and learn what she could. She had no idea how long she had slept. It might have been minutes or hours or even longer. She thought, though, that it was still the same night. Logic told her it must be. She thought, too, that whatever it was that had her, it was not the thing that had pursued her into the hollows. Had that thing found her, it would simply have killed her. This, therefore, must be something else. The old man, Heebel, had told Will and her that the hollows were the private domain of the witch sisters. Perhaps it was one of them that had her. She felt somewhat better, having reasoned that much through, and she relaxed a bit, trying to make out something of the terrain through which she was moving. It was difficult to do this. The trees shut away even the smallest trace of stars and moon, leaving everything shrouded in deepest night. Were it not for the familiar woodland smells, she might not have known there was a forest about. The silence was intense. The few sounds were distant and brief, cries that came from the wilderness beyond the hollows. Yet there was another sound, she corrected herself, a sort of skittering noise like the chafing of limbs in a breeze. Except that there was no breeze, and the sound came from beneath her, not from above. Whatever it was that carried her was making the noise. The minutes slipped by. She thought briefly of Will, trying to imagine what he might do in her place. That made her smile in spite of herself. Who could tell what wild stunt Will might try in such a situation? Then she wondered if she would ever see him again. Her muscles were beginning to cramp, and she decided to see if she could do something to ease the discomfort without giving herself away. Experimentally, she stretched her legs, pretending to stir in her sleep, testing the fingers that held her. They moved with her, but did not release. So much for that. The sound of running water reached her, growing stronger with each passing second. She could smell it now, fresh and scented with wildflowers, a stream that twisted and churned in the quiet of the forest. Then it was beneath her, and the rustle of the sticks and the night sounds faded in its rush. Footsteps echoed hollowly on wooden planks, and she knew she had been carried over a bridge. The gurgle of the stream faded slightly. Chains clanked and rumbled as if being gathered in, and there was a dull thud. Something had closed behind. A door. A very heavy door. An iron bar and locks snapped into place. She heard them clearly. Night air washed about her as before, but it carried with it the unmistakable smell of stone and mortar. Fear welled up within her once more. She was inside a walled area, a courtyard perhaps, being taken, she now believed, to some sort of confinement, and if she did not break free at once, she would not break free at all. Yet the fingers that constrained her showed not the slightest hint of loosening, and there were many of them. It would take a tremendous effort to wrench free, and she did not believe that she had that kind of strength left in her. Besides, she thought dismally, even if she were to break free, where would she go? Ahead, another door opened, creaking slightly. Still, no light came to her. There was nothing but blackness all about.
"Pretty thing," a voice said suddenly, and the elven girl started with surprise.
She was carried ahead. Behind her, the door closed and the smells of the forest disappeared. She was inside. But inside of what? Twisting and turning, her captors carried her along passageways that smelled damp and musty. Yet there was another odor, a kind of incense, a perfume. The elven girl breathed it deeply, and it left her head in a momentary spin. Then at last there was a light, suddenly, unexpectedly, glimmering just ahead from within a tall archway. Amberlee blinked at the unfamiliar brightness, her eyes still accustomed to the dark. She was carried through the archway and down a winding stair. The light blinked above her, fell behind momentarily, then followed after, weaving and bobbing against the dark. Her forward motion stopped. She felt herself being lowered onto a thick, woven matting, and the wooden fingers slipped free. She raised herself up on her elbows and squinted toward the light. It hung there before her for just an instant, then retreated slowly behind a wall of iron bars. A door swung shut, and the light was gone. But just before it disappeared, the elven girl caught a glimpse of her captors, their slender forms outlined clearly in the white glow. They appeared to be made out of sticks. On the floor of the hollows, Will called a halt. It was so black that he could barely see his hand in front of his face. He could not see Hebel or Eretria at all, nor they him. If they attempted to proceed under these conditions, they would soon become separated and hopelessly lost. He waited a few moments for his vision to sharpen. It did, but only slightly. The hollows remained a dim, barely perceptible mass of shadows. It was Hebel who came up with a plan to resolve their difficulty. Whistling Drifter to him, he produced a length of rope from the sack he carried and bound one end to the dog. The rest he fastened about his waist and to the waists of the Veilman and the Rover girl. Thus tied, they could follow after one another without risk of separation. The old man tested the line, then spoke softly to Drifter. The big dog started ahead. It seemed to Will as if they walked the hollows for hours, stumbling through an endless maze of trees and brush, nearly blind in the impenetrable blackness, trusting to the instincts of the dog that led them. They did not talk to one another at all, moving through the forest as silently as they could, all too conscious of the fact that somewhere within that same forest the Reaper prowled. Will had never felt quite so helpless as he did then. It was bad enough that he could see almost nothing. It was worse knowing that the Reaper was down there with him. He thought constantly of Amberlee. If he were frightened, what must it be like for her? His fear made him ashamed. He had no right to be afraid, not when she was the one who was alone and unprotected, and he was the one who had left her that way. Yet the fear stayed with him. To ward it off, he clutched the pouch with the elf stones in one hand, grasping it firmly, as if having it there might somehow protect him against whatever hid within the forest night. Yet deep within, the feeling persisted that the elf stones would not protect him, that their power was lost to him and he could not get it back again. It made no difference what Amberlee had told him or what he had told himself. The feeling lacked reason or purpose. It was simply there, haunting, malignant, terrifying. The power of the elfstones was no longer his. He was still trying to shake the feeling when the rope before him went suddenly slack. He almost stumbled over Hebel, who had come to a complete stop. Eretria bumped up against him, and the three stood bunched together, peering ahead into the gloom. "Drift has found something," the old man whispered to Will. Dropping to his knees, he worked his way forward to where Drifter was sniffing the ground, Will and Eretria following close behind. He patted the dog soothingly and felt along the earth for a time, then rose. "Malinrow," he spoke her name softly.
She's got the elfling girl.
Are you sure? Will whispered back.
The old man nodded. Has to be. That reaper thing's somewhere else now. Drifter doesn't smell it anymore.
Will did not understand how Hebel could be certain of all this, especially when it was so impossibly black. There was no point in arguing the matter.
What do we do now? He asked anxiously.
Keep going, Hebel grunted. Drifter, go, boy.
The dog started ahead once more, the three humans trailing after. The minutes slipped away, and gradually the forest began to lighten. At first, Will thought his eyes were playing tricks on him, but finally he realized that night was fading, and a new day had begun. Trees and brush began to take shape about him, the dimness sharpening slowly as the sun slipped its faint glow through the forest roof. Ahead, the shaggy black form of Drifter became visible for the first time since they had descended from the hollow's rim, head lowered to the trail as he sniffed his way along the damp earth. Then abruptly the big head lifted and the dog stopped. The humans stopped with him, startled looks on their faces. Before them stood the strangest creature that any of them had ever seen. It was a man made of sticks. Two arms, two legs, and a body, all of sticks, gnarled roots curling out from the ends of the arms and legs to form fingers and toes. It had no head. It faced them, or at least they thought it faced them, since the roots that formed its fingers and toes appeared to point in their direction. Its slender body swayed slightly as if it were a sapling caught in a sudden wind. Then it turned and walked back into the forest. Hebel glanced quickly at the other two.
I told you. That's Malinrow's work.
Beckoning hurriedly to them, he started after the creature. Will and Eretria looked doubtfully at each other, then followed. Wordlessly, the little procession trudged ahead into the gloom, weaving and twisting through the maze of the forest. After a time, other stick men like the first began to appear about them, headless, gnarled things, noiseless but for the slight skittering sound they made as they walked. Almost before the humans knew it, there were dozens of the creatures ringing them, trailing like ghosts through the shadows.
I told you, Hebel kept whispering back to the Veilman and the Rover girl, his leathered face intense.
Then abruptly the forest thinned. Before them stood a solitary tower, its dark turret rising up into the trees that grew about it. It sat atop a small knoll, a nearly windowless keep, its stone aged, worn, and grown thick with vines and moss. The knoll had become an island, encircled by a stream that flowed from somewhere back in the forest, wending its way down in a series of drops and turns before meandering off into the trees to their left. A low wall ringed the tower, built close to the bank of the stream. Where it faced them, a drawbridge stood open and empty, chains hanging limply from small watchhouses at either side, a heavy wooden bridgehead spanning the waters beneath. All about the rise and the tower grew massive oaks, ancient trees whose boughs interwove and shut away the morning sky, leaving the isle, like the rest of the hollows, draped in deepest shadow. The stick man they had followed stopped. It turned about slightly, as if its headless form would ascertain whether or not they were there. Then it began walking toward the drawbridge. Hebel limped after it without hesitating, Drifter at his side. Will and Eretria hung back a moment, less certain than the old man that they ought to go further. The tower was a forbidding structure. They knew that they should not set foot within its walls, knew that they had already gone much farther than they should. But the Veilman sensed somehow that it was here he would find Amberley. He looked back at Eretria, and they started forward. Down to the edge of the stream the little band went, following the silent stick man, its brethren all about them. Except for the sounds of their movements and the flow of the stream, the forest lay wrapped in silence. The stick man stepped onto the bridgehead and walked across, fading from sight in the shadow of the gate. The men, The girl and the dog passed over the bridge behind it, Will and Eritrea casting apprehensive glances at the massive black tower beyond. Then they were beneath the gate. The stick man reappeared before them, standing now just beyond the shadowed arch. In a line, they moved forward, watching as it started once more toward the tower. They had barely walked clear of the gateway when they heard the sudden sound of chains creaking and groaning. Behind them, the drawbridge lifted and sealed against the wall. Now there was no turning back. In a knot, they walked to the tower. The stick man was waiting, standing within a high alcove that sheltered a pair of broad, iron-bound wooden doors. One door stood open. The stick man stepped through and was gone. Will stared upward at the massive stone face of the tower, then reached into his tunic and brought forth the pouch that contained the elf stones. With the others, he stepped through the doorway into blackness. For an instant, no one moved, standing just within the entry, peering blindly into the gloom. Then the door swung shut behind them, locks snapping into place. Light flared from within a glass-enclosed lamp that hung suspended from above, its glow white and soft, neither from burning oil nor pitch, but something that gave off no flame as it burned. All about stood the stick men, their gnarled shadows cast upon stone walls, swaying gently in the light. From the gloom behind them, a woman appeared, cloaked all in black and trailing long streamers of crimson nightshade. "Malinrow," Hebel whispered, and Will Ohmsford felt the air about him turn to ice.
Chapter 42.
The second day of the battle for Arbalon belonged to Andor Elicidal. It was a day of blood and pain, of death and great courage. All during the night, the demon hordes had continued to ferry their brethren across the waters of the Rillsong, singly and in groups, until for the first time since their break from the Forbidding, the whole of their army was gathered to strike, massed at the base of the Carolan from cliff face to riverbank, stretched north and south as far as the eye could see, awesome and terrible and endless in number. At dawn they attacked the city. Up against the walls of the Elfich they rushed, wave upon wave, maddened and howling with hate. Up against the heights they surged, scrambling onto the sheer rock, clawing their way through a hail of arrows. Onward they came like a wave that would sweep across the defenders who waited and leave them buried. It was Andor Elicidal who made the difference. It was as if on that day he became at last the king his father had been, the king who had led the elves against the armies of the warlock lord those 50 years past. Gone was the weariness and the disillusion. Gone was the doubt that had haunted him since Halley's cut. He believed again in himself and in the determination of those who fought with him. It was an historic moment, and the elven prince became its focal point. Gathered about him were the armies of 4 races, battle standards flying in the morning wind. Here were the silver war eagles and spreading oak of the elves, the gray and crimson slash of the Free Corps, and the black horses of the old guard. There flew the forest greens of the dwarf sappers, split by the twist of the Silver River, and the hammer and twin blue mountains of the rock trolls of the Kershalt. Never before had they flown as one. In the history of the 4 lands, the races had never before been united in a common cause, to form a common defense, and to serve a common good. Troll and dwarf, elf and man. The humans of the New World stood together against an evil from ancient times. For that single, wondrous day, Andor Elicidal became the spark that gave them all life. He was everywhere at once, from the rim of the bluff to the gates of the Elfich, sometimes on horseback, sometimes afoot, always where the fighting was the heaviest. Chainmail gleaming, Elkris' staff held high, he stood foremost among the defenders of the city against the demons who rushed to slay him. Wherever he went, the cry went up and the defenders rallied. Always outnumbered, always pressed, still the elven prince and his comrades-at-arms threw back their attackers. Andor Elisidal was something more than human that day, fighting with such ferocity that it seemed as if nothing could stand against him. Time after time the demons sought to pull him down, recognizing quickly that this single man was the heart of the elven defense. Time after time it seemed as if they would succeed, ringing Andor in a swarm of raging black bodies. But each time he fought his way free, each time the demons were driven back. It was a day of heroes, for all of the defenders of Arbalon were inspired by the courage of the elven prince. Even Tyne Elisidal stood with his son and fought bravely, his very presence lending heart to the elves about him. Alanon was there as well, his cloaked form standing head and shoulders above the armored men about him as the blue fire arced from his fingers into the midst of the raging demons. Twice the demons broke through the gates of the third ramp, and twice the rock trolls under the command of Amintar drove them back again. Steed Jans and the men of the Free Corps broke a third assault, counterattacking with such savagery that they swept the demons all the way back to the second ramp and for a time threatened to retake its gates. Elven cavalry and dwarf sappers repulsed sally after sally along the rim of the Carolan, throwing back scores of demons who managed to scale the cliff face and threatened to flank the defenders on the Elfich. But it was Andor who led them, Andor who gave them renewed strength when it seemed that they could stand no longer, Andor who rallied them at every point. When the day at last was ended and darkness began to fall, the demons were forced to withdraw once more, slipping back into the forests below the heights, shrieking with rage and frustration. For yet a second day, the defenders of Arbalon had held. It was Andor Elisidal's finest hour. Then the fortunes of the defenders of the city took a turn for the worse. With the coming of night, the demons attacked again, waiting only until the sunlight was gone, then rising up out of the forests to sweep over the elven defense. One by one they extinguished the torches that had been lit along the lower Elfich, battling their way forward to the gates of the third ramp. Desperately the defenders braced for the assault, massive rock trolls blocking the gates while elves and legion soldiers fought from atop the walls. But the rush was too strong. The gates buckled and snapped apart. Into the breach surged the demons, clawing their way forward. On the heights as well, the demons began to break through. Dozens of black forms slipped between the lines of cavalry patrolling the bluff and scattered wildly toward the city. Of these, more than 100 converged on the Gardens of Life, aware that within its gates stood the thing that for so many centuries had held them imprisoned. There they came face to face with the soldiers of the Black Watch, who stood ready to fulfill the purpose of their order and to defend to the last man the ancient tree that was their trust. Maddened beyond reason, the demons attacked. Up against the lowered pikes of the Black Watch, they charged and were cut to pieces. At the southern end of the Carolan, another band of demons managed to tunnel beneath a line of dwarf traps set along a dismantled secondary stairway leading up from the Rilsong and thus gain the heights. Skirting the Black Watch and the Gardens of Life, they slipped east away from the Carolan, crawling through the shadows behind the line of torches set against its rim and broke for the city. Half a dozen elven wounded, en route to their homes from the battle, were caught in the open and killed. More might have perished but for a patrol of dwarf sappers, who had agreed to aid the elves in keeping watch along the perimeter of the city. Realizing that the demons had broken through the defenders of the bluff, they followed the cries of the dying and fell upon their slayers. When the struggle was ended, only 3 dwarves were still standing. All the demons lay dead. By dawn, the heights had been cleared and the demons thrown back once more. But the third ramp of the Elfich had been lost, and the fourth was threatened. At the base of the bluff, the demons massed anew. Cries rang out through the morning stillness as they charged up the ramp, solidly massed, the foremost among them bearing a massive wooden battering ram. Into the gates they carried the ram, smashing the wooden barrier apart, then pouring through. Trolls and elves formed quickly into a tight phalanx, a wall of iron spears and lances that cut deep into the writhing black forms. But the demons came on, surging up against the harried defenders until they had forced them back within the fortress of the fifth ramp. It was a desperate moment. Four of the seven levels of the Elfich had been lost. The demons were halfway to the summit of the bluffs. Ander rallied the defenders, flanked by Amintar and Karin and surrounded by Homeguard. The demons charged, hammering against the gates of the ramp. But just when it seemed that they must break through, Alanon appeared on the walls, arms lifting. Blue flame raced the length of the ramp below, splitting wide the demon rush, turning the battering ram to ash. Momentarily stunned, the demons fell back. All through the morning, the demons sought to breach the elven defense of the fifth ramp. At midday, they finally succeeded. A pair of monstrous ogres pushed to the forefront of their brethren and threw themselves against the gates. Once, twice. Wood and iron shattered into fragments and the gates broke apart. The ogres burst through onto the ramp beyond, scattering the defenders. A handful of rock trolls tried to stop them, but the ogres shoved the trolls aside as if they were made of paper. Again, Ander rallied his soldiers, urging them forward. But demons were pouring through the ruined gates now, sweeping over the defenders. Then even Tyne Elicidal's horse was killed beneath him as he rode back toward the safety of the gates above, and the old king tumbled to the rampway. The demons saw him fall. With a howl, they surged forward. They would have had him but for Stee Jans. With a scattering of Legion Free Corps, the Borderman sprang into their path, swords cutting. Behind them, Eventine staggered to his knees, dazed and bloodied but alive. Quickly, Karin brought the Home Guard to the King's rescue, and they carried him from the battle. The soldiers of the Free Corps held for a moment longer, then they too were swept aside. The demons pushed forward, thrusting past the elves who tried to bar their way. Leading the assault were the ogres who had forced the gates, crushing all who came within reach. Ander Elicidal leaped to stop them, Elkris staff raised high as he called to the defenders of the city to stand with him. But the rush was too strong. Amintar and Stee Jans were fighting for their lives at the walls of the ramp, unable to reach the elven prince. For one terrifying moment he stood virtually alone before the demon rush. But only for a moment. Atop the gates of the sixth court, Alanon whistled Dane down from the edge of the Carolan. Without a word, he snatched Dancer's reins from the surprised wing rider and vaulted atop the giant rock. In the next instant, he was winging downward, black robes billowing out like sails. Dancer screamed once, then dropped into the midst of the demons who threatened Ander, claws and beak tearing. Shrieking, the black form scattered. Blue fire spurted from the druid's fingers, and the ramp before him erupted in flame. Then pulling an astonished Ander up beside him, the druid called out to Dancer, and the rock lifted back into the air. Below, the last of the defenders fell back, pouring through the gates of the sixth ramp to safety. For a few seconds longer, the druid fire burned, then sputtered and died. Enraged, the demons charged after the fleeing defenders. But by now the dwarf sappers on the heights had been alerted. Winches and pulleys began to turn as the chains wrapped about the supports of the ramp were drawn tight. Browork's carefully concealed trap was about to be sprung. Out from beneath the elfish flew the already weakened supports, cracking and snapping as the chains twisted them free. With a shudder, the ramp head below the sixth level sank downward and fell apart. The demons caught upon it disappeared in a cloud of rubble. Shrieks and cries filled the air, and the whole of the lower ramp was lost from view. When the dust cleared again, the elfage was a pile of crushed stone and shattered wooden beams from the gates of the sixth ramp downward to the fourth. Demon bodies lay scattered on the cliff face, lodged within the rubble, broken and lifeless. Those who had survived fell back toward the base of the bluff, dodging boulders and debris that tumbled down about them, disappearing finally into the woodlands below. The demons did not come again that day against the city of Arbalon. Suffering from yet another head wound, as well as from a number of smaller cuts and scrapes, Eventine Elicidal was carried from the battle atop the Elfich to the seclusion of his manor house. Faithful Gale was there to care for him, to wash and dress his wounds, and to help him to his bed. Then, with Dardan and Ro to watch over him, the King of the Elves was left to sleep. But Eventine did not sleep. He could not. He lay within his bed, propped up against the feathered pillows, staring disconsolately into the darkened corners of the room, despair washing through him. For all the help that the Legion, the dwarves, and the rock trolls had given the elves, the battle was still being lost. All of their defenses had failed. Another day, perhaps two, and the sixth and seventh gates of the Elfich would fall, and the demons would be atop the Carolan. That would be the end. Hopelessly outnumbered, the defenders would be swiftly overrun and destroyed. The Westland would be lost, and the elves scattered to the four winds. The implications behind what he was thinking burned through him. If the demons won here, it would mean that Eventine Elicidal had failed. Not just his own people, but the peoples of all the lands. For the demons would not stop with the Westland, now that they were free of the forbidding. And what of his ancestors who had imprisoned the demons so many centuries ago, at a time so remote that he could barely envision its being? He would have failed them as well. They had created the forbidding, but they had entrusted its care to those who followed after them, depending on those who came after to keep it strong. Yet the forbidding had been forgotten over the centuries in the upheaval of the old world and the rebirth of the races, forgotten by them all. Even the Chosen had come to think of it as little more than a distant part of their history, a legend that belonged to another age, to the past or to the future, yet never really to the present. His throat tightened. If Arbalon fell, if the Westland were lost, it would be his failure. His. His penetrating blue eyes turned hard with anger. For 82 years he had lived upon this earth. For more than 50 of them he had been the leader of his people. He had accomplished much in that time. And now it would all be lost. He thought of Arion, his firstborn, the child who should have lived to carry on what he had worked so hard to achieve, and of Kael Pindannon, his old comrade at arms, his loyal follower. He thought of the elves who had been lost, defending the Serendannon and Arbalon. All of them dead, and for nothing. He eased himself down within the coverings of the bed, mulling over the choices that were left, the tactics that might yet be employed, the resources that might be called upon when the demons came again. His mind filled with them, and deep within he felt a sense of hopelessness. They were not enough. They would never be enough. Groping for answers to the questions he posed himself, he suddenly remembered Amberley. It startled him to think of her, and he sat upright in the bed. In the confusion of the past few days, he had forgotten his granddaughter, she who was the last of the Chosen, who Alanon had told him was the only real hope for his people. What, he wondered sadly, had become of Amberley? He lay down again and stared through the shadow of the drapes to the growing darkness beyond. Al-Anon had said that Amberley was alive, by now deep within the Lower Westland, but Eventine did not believe that the druid really knew. The thought depressed him. If she were dead, he did not want to know, he decided suddenly. It would be better that way, not knowing. Yet that was a lie. He needed to know, desperately. Bitterness welled up within him. Everything was slipping away from him. His family, his people, his country, everything he loved, everything that had given meaning to his life. There was a basic unfairness to it all that he could not understand. No, it was more than that. The basic unfairness of it all was something he could not accept. If he did, he knew that it would finish him. He closed his eyes against the light. Where was Amberley? He must know, he insisted stubbornly. He must find a way to reach her, to help her, if his help were needed. He must find a way to bring her back to him. He took a deep breath, then another. Still thinking of Amberley, he drifted off to sleep. It was dark when he awoke. At first he was not certain what it was that brought him awake, his mind still drugged with sleep, his thoughts scattered. A sound, he thought. A cry. He raised himself up against the gathering of pillows and stared into the darkness of the room. Pale white moonlight seeped through the fabric of the drawn curtains, illuminating faintly the lines of the bolted double windows. Uncertain, he waited. Then he heard another sound, a muted grunt, quick and surprised, fading almost instantly into silence. It had come from outside his room, from the hall where Darden and Rowe stood watch. He sat up slowly, peering into the gloom, straining to hear something more. But there was only the silence, deep and ominous. Eventine slid to the edge of the bed and dropped one leg cautiously to the floor. The door to his bedchamber swung slowly open, light from the oil lamps of the hallway beyond spilling into the room. The Elven King froze. Through the opening came Manx, heavy body hunched forward in a low crouch, grizzled head swinging to where his master sat upon the bed. The wolfhound's eyes glittered like a cat's, and his dark muzzle was streaked with blood. But it was his forelegs and paws that startled the king most. They seemed, in the half-light, to have become the corded limbs and claws of a demon. Manx passed from the light of the oil lamps into shadow, and Eventine blinked in surprise. In that instant he was certain that what he had seen was something left over from a dream, that he had imagined that Manx was not Manx, but something else. The wolfhound moved toward him slowly, and the king could see that his tail was wagging in a friendly manner. He exhaled in relief. It was just Manx, he told himself. Manx, good boy, he started to say, and stopped as he caught sight of the reddened tracks that the dog had left on the floor behind him. Then Manx was springing for his throat, quick and silent, jaws gaping wide, clawed hands reaching. But Eventine was quicker. Snatching the coverings from the bed before him, he caught Manx within their folds. Twisting the coverings about the struggling dog, the king slammed the animal down hard upon the bed and sprang for the open door. In an instant he was through, yanking the door shut behind him, hearing the latch snap into place. Sweat ran down his body. What was happening? In a daze, he stumbled back from the door, nearly tripping over the lifeless body of Roe, who lay sprawled half a dozen feet away, his throat ripped open. Eventine's mind whirled. Manx? Why would Manx? He caught himself sharply. But it was not Manx. Whatever it was that had come at him within his sleeping chamber was not Manx, just something that looked like Manx. Numb, he started down the hallway, searching for Darden.
He found him near the front entry, a lance driven through his heart. Then the door to his bedchamber burst open, and the thing that looked like Manx, yet surely was not, bounded into view. Frantic, Eventine sprang for the entry doors, wrenching at the handles. They were jammed, the locks sealed. The old king turned, watching as the beast in the hall stalked slowly toward him, reddened jaws gaping. Fear surged through Eventine, fear so terrible that for an instant it threatened to overwhelm him completely. He was trapped within his own house. There was no one to help him, no one that he might turn to. He was alone. Down the length of the hall the monster came, the sound of its breathing a slow rasp in the silence. A demon, Eventine thought in horror, a demon pretending to be Manx, faithful old Manx. He remembered then awakening after the fall of the Serendanon to find Manx and thinking suddenly, irrationally, that it was not Manx at all, but something else. An illusion, he had thought, but he had been wrong. Manx was gone, dead, he guessed, for many days, even weeks. Then the awful truth dawned on him. His meetings with Al-Anon, the plans they had worked so hard to keep secret, the care they had taken to protect Amberley. Manx had been there, or the demon that looked like Manx. There was a spy within the elven camp, Al-Anon had warned, a spy that all the while had been as close to them as they had been to each other. The old king thought of the times that he had stroked that grizzled head, and it made his skin crawl. The demon was less than a dozen feet from him now, inching along the floor, jaws open, clawed forelegs bent. Eventine knew in that instant that he was a dead man. Then something happened within him, something so sudden that the elven king was blinded to everything else. Rage swept through him. Rage at the deception that had been done him, rage at the deaths that had occurred because of that deception, and most of all, rage at the helplessness he felt now, trapped as he was within his own house. His body went taut. Next to the fallen Dardan lay the short sword that had been the elven hunter's favorite weapon. Keeping his eyes fixed upon those of the demon, Eventine inched away from the doors. If he could manage to reach that sword. The demon came at him suddenly, bounding across the space that separated them, launching itself at the elven king's head. Eventine brought his arms up to protect his face and fell backward, kicking violently. Teeth and claws ripped into his forearms, but his feet caught the underside of the creature and sent it tumbling past him into the darkened recesses of the entry. Quickly he rolled back to his feet, throwing himself over Dardan and grasping the fallen sword. Then he was up again, turning to face his attacker. Astonishment flooded his face. From the darkened corner where it had tumbled, the demon slouched, no longer Manx, but something different now. It was changing even as it stalked toward him, changing from Manx into a lean black thing, corded with muscle, its body sleek and hairless. It came at him on four legs that ended in clawed hands, and its mouth split wide with gleaming teeth. It circled the king, lifting itself from time to time on its hind legs, feinting with its hands like a boxer, hissing with hate. A changeling, Eventine thought, and forced down a new wave of fear. A demon that could be anything it wanted to be. The changeling lunged at him suddenly, claws ripping at his shoulder and side, leaving him torn and bloodied. He swung at the thing with the sword. Too late. It was past him and gone before he could reach it. Back the demon circled slowly, like a cat watching its cornered prey. "I must be quicker this time," the old king told himself. The demon lunged again, feinted at his chest, and slipped beneath the arc of his sword, tearing at the muscles of his left leg. Pain shot through the leg, and he dropped to his knees, struggling to remain upright. For an instant, his vision blurred, then cleared once more as he forced himself to rise.
Before him the changeling crouched, waiting. When he stayed on his feet, it began to circle once more. Blood streamed down Eventine's body, and he felt himself weakening. He was losing this battle as well, he thought frantically, and it would end in his death if he did not find a way to take the offensive against this monster. Weaving and bobbing, the demon stalked him. The king tried to corner it, but it stepped nimbly away from him, far too quick for the wounded old man. Eventine stopped his pursuit. It was gaining him nothing. He watched as the demon continued to circle, hissing. Then, in a desperate gamble, the elven king pretended to stumble and fall, staggering heavily to his knees. Pain shot through him as he did so, but the deception worked. Thinking the old man finished, the changeling lunged. But this time Eventine was waiting. He caught the monster in the chest, the sword biting deep through bone and muscle. Shrieking in pain, the demon clawed and bit at the elven king, then twisted free. Blood ran from the slash, a greenish-red ichor that stained the sleek black body. They crouched face to face, elven king and demon, both wounded, each waiting for the other to drop his guard. Once more the demon began to circle, blood trailing after it along the floor. Eventine Elicital braced, turning to follow the demon's movement. He was covered with blood and his strength was ebbing from him. Pain racked his torn body. He knew that he could only last a few minutes more. Abruptly, the changeling sprang at his throat. It happened so quickly that the king did not have time to do much more than tumble backward, arms raised before his face, sword held high. The demon landed on top of him, bearing him to the floor, teeth and claws ripping. Eventine screamed in pain as the claws tore into his chest and the jaws closed about his forearm. Then the doors to the manor house burst apart, locks splintering, hinges ripped from their fastenings. Shouts rang through the darkened entryway as it filled with armed men. In a haze of anguish, Eventine cried out. Someone had heard. Someone had come. From atop the fallen king, the changeling rose up, shrieking. In that instant, it left its throat exposed. Eventine's sword swept up, glittering. Back flew the demon, head nearly severed from its body, its voice lost in a sudden gasp. As it fell, the king's rescuers closed in about it, swords thrusting deep into its body. The changeling shuddered with the impact of the blows and died. Eventine Elicital staggered to his feet, sword still clutched within his hand, blue eyes hard and fixed. A numbing sensation spread through his body as he turned to find Ander reaching out for him. Then the king of the elves tumbled downward, and the night closed in. Chapter 43. Like Mistress Death, she came for the humans, taller even than Alanon, gray hair long and woven thick with nightshade, black robes trailing from her slender form, a whisper of silk in the deep silence of the tower. She was beautiful, her face delicate and finely wrought, her skin so pale that she seemed almost ethereal. There was an ageless look to her, a timelessness, as if she were a thing that had always been and would forever be. The stick men fell back from her as she approached, the clicking of their wooden legs a faint rustle in the gloom. She passed them without a glance, her strange violet eyes never leaving the three who stood transfixed in her presence. Her hands stretched forth, small and fragile, their fingers curving as if to draw them close.
Malinroe!
Hebel whispered her name a second time, his voice expectant. She stopped, her perfect features devoid of expression as she looked down upon the old man. Then she turned to Eretria and finally to Will. The veilman had gone so cold that he was shaking.
I am Malinroe, she said,
her voice soft and distant. Why are you here?
No one spoke, their eyes riveted on her. She waited a moment, then her pale hand passed before them. The hollows are forbidden. No human is allowed. The hollows are my home, and within them I hold the power of life and death over all living things. To those who please me, I grant life. To those who do not, death. It has always been so. It will always be. She looked at each of them in turn carefully this time, violet eyes reaching out to hold their own. Finally, her gaze rested on Hebel.
Who are you, old man? Why have you come to the hollows?
Hebel swallowed.
I was looking for you, I guess.
His words stumbled over one another.
I brought you something, Malinro.
Her hand stretched forth.
What have you brought me?
Hebel removed the sack he carried, lifted its flap, and fumbled through its contents, searching. A moment later he withdrew a polished wooden figure, a statue carved from a piece of oak. It was Malinro, captured so perfectly that it seemed as if she had stepped from the carving into life. She took the wooden figure from the old man and examined it, her slender fingers running slowly over its polished surface.
A pretty thing, she said finally. It is you,
Hebel told her quickly. She looked back at him, and Will did not like what he saw. The smile she gave the old man was faint and cold.
I know you, she said, then paused as her eyes studied anew his leathered face. Long ago it was, upon the rim of the hollows, when you were still young. A night I gave you. I remembered, Hebel whispered, pointing quickly to the wooden figure. I remembered what you were like.
At Hebel's feet, Drifter crouched against the stone floor of the tower and whined, but the old man never heard him. He had lost himself completely in the witch's eyes. She shook her gray head slowly.
It was a whim, foolish one, she whispered.
Holding the statue, she stepped past him to where Eretria stood. The rover girl's eyes were wide and frightened as the witch came up to her.
What have you brought me?
Malinrow's question teased through the silence. Eretria was speechless. Desperately she looked at Will, then back again to Malinrow. The witch's hand passed once before her eyes in a gesture that was both soothing and commanding.
Pretty thing, Malinrow smiled. Have you brought yourself?
Eretria's slender body shook.
Do you care for this one?
Malinro pointed suddenly to Will. She turned to face the Veilman.
He cares for someone else, I think. An elven girl, perhaps? Is this so?
Will nodded slowly. Her strange eyes held his own, and her words reached out to him, bold and insistent.
It is you who holds the magic.
Magic? Will stammered in reply. Her hands slipped back within the black robes.
Show it to me.
So compelling was her voice that before Will Ohmsford knew what he had done, he had opened the hand that held the leather pouch. She nodded to him faintly.
Show it to me, she repeated.
Unable to help himself, the Veilman emptied the elf stones from the pouch into his outstretched hand. Cupped within his palm, they glittered and flared.
Malinro drew in her breath sharply, and one hand lifted toward them. Elf stones, she said softly. Blue for the seeker.
Her eyes found Will's.
Shall they be your gift to me?
Will tried to speak, but the cold within him tightened, and no words came from his lips. His hand locked before him, and he could not draw it back again. Malenroe's eyes looked deep into his own. What he saw there terrified him. She wanted him to know what she could do to him. The witch stepped back. Wisp, she called. From the shadows sidled a small, furry-looking creature, like a gnome in appearance, with the face of a wizened old man. Scurrying to Malenroe's side, the creature peered up at the cold face anxiously.
Yes, lady, Wisp serves only you.
There are gifts. She smiled faintly, her voice trailing into silence. Wordlessly, she handed Wisp the wooden statue of herself, then moved back to stand again before Hebel. Wisp hastened after, crouching down within the folds of her cloak. Old man, she addressed Hebel, her pale face bending close to his own. What would you have me do with you? Hebel seemed to have recovered his senses. His eyes were no longer distant as they glanced quickly at the witch and then away again.
Me? I don't know.
Her smile was hard. Perhaps you should stay here within the hollows. It doesn't matter, he insisted, as if he sensed somehow that the witch would do with him as she pleased anyway. Then he looked up. But the elflings, Malenroe. Help them. You could help them, she cut him short. The old man nodded.
If you want me to stay, I will. There's nothing else for me. But let them go. Give them the help they need.
She laughed softly. Perhaps there is something that you can do to help them, old man.
But I have done all that I can. Perhaps not.
If I told you there was something more that you might do, you would be willing to do it, wouldn't you? Her eyes fixed the old man. Will saw that the witch was toying with him. Hebel looked uncertain.
I don't know.
Of course you know, she said softly. Look at me. His head lifted. They are your friends. You want to help them, don't you? The veilman was frantic. Something was terribly wrong, but he could neither move nor speak to warn Hebel. He caught a glimpse of Eritrea's frightened face. She, too, sensed the danger. Hebel sensed it as well, but he sensed, too, that he could not escape it. His eyes met those of the witch. I want to help them. Malenroe nodded. Then so you shall, old man. She reached to touch his face. Hebel saw in the witch's eyes what was to become of him. Drifter rose, teeth suddenly bared, but Hebel's hand caught the back of the big dog's neck and held him fast. The time for resistance was over. The witch's fingers stroked the old man's bearded cheek gently, and his whole body seemed to go suddenly rigid. No, Will tried to scream, but it was already too late. Malenroe's cloak enfolded both Hebel and Drifter, and they were lost from sight. The cloak remained wrapped about them for a moment, then slipped free. Malenroe stood alone. In one hand she held a perfectly sculpted wooden carving of the old man and the dog. In this way shall you help them best. She smiled coldly. She handed the wooden figures to Wisp, who gathered them in. Then she turned to Eritrea. Now what shall I do with you, pretty one? She whispered. Her hand lifted and a single finger pointed. Eritrea was forced to her knees, head bowed. The fingers curled back and Eritrea's hands stretched out to the witch in a gesture of submission. Tears streaked her face. Malinrow watched without comment for a moment, then looked abruptly at Will.
Would you see her become a wooden statue as well?
Her voice had an edge to it that cut through the veilman like a knife. Still, he could not speak.
Or the elven girl, perhaps.
You know, of course, that I have her. She did not wait for the response she knew he could not give. She stepped forward, her tall figure bending down until her face was close before his own.
I wish the elf stones, and you shall give them to me. You shall give them, elfling, for I know that if they are taken from you by force, they are useless.
Her violet eyes burned into him.
I would have their magic. Do you understand? I know their worth far better than you. I am older than this world and its races, older than the druids who played at Paranor with magics long since mastered by my sister and me. It is so with the elfstones. Though I am not of elven blood, yet my blood is the blood of all the races, and so I may command their power. Still, even I cannot break the law that calls their power into being. The elf stones must be given freely.
And so they shall.
Her hand came close before his face, nearly touching it.
I have a sister, elfling.
Morag, she has named herself.
For centuries we have lived within these hollows, called the Witch Sisters, the last of our coven. Once, long ago, she wronged me greatly, and I have never forgiven. I would have been rid of her except that our powers match so evenly that neither one nor the other of us may prevail.
Ah. But the elf stones are a magic that my sister does not possess, a magic that will enable me to put an end to her.
Morag, odious Morag, sweet to see her made to serve me as these men of Styx, sweet to still that hateful voice. Oh, I have waited long to be rid of her, elfling, long.
Her voice rose as she spoke until the words rang against the stones of the tower, echoing through the deep stillness. The beautiful, cold face moved back from the veilman, the slender arms folding within the black robes. Will Ohmsford could feel the sweat running down his body.
The elf stones shall be your gift to me, she whispered. My gift to you shall be your life and the lives of the women. Accept my gift. Remember the old man. Think of him before you choose.
She stopped as the door to the tower slipped open to admit a handful of the stick men. They came to her in a scuttling of wooden legs, clustering about her. She bent low about them for a moment, then straightened, glancing coldly at Will.
"You have brought a demon into the hollows," she cried. "A demon, after all these years. It must be found and destroyed. Wisp, his gift."
The furry creature hastened forward and took from the helpless veilman the pouch and the elf stones. The wizened face glanced up at him, then withdrew behind the folds of Malinrow's cloak. The witch lifted her hand, and Will felt himself grow suddenly weak.
"Remember what you have seen, elfling."
Her voice seemed distant now.
"I hold the power of life and death. Choose wisely."
She moved past him and disappeared through the open door. His strength began to fail, his vision to blur. At his side, Eretria collapsed on the tower floor. Then he was also falling. The last thing he remembered was the feel of wooden fingers closing tight about his body.
Chapter 44.
Will.
The sound of his name hung like an echo, strayed in the black haze which enveloped him. The voice seemed to come from a great distance, floating downward through the dark to probe him in his sleep. He stirred sluggishly, feeling as if he were weighted and bound. With a great effort, he reached up from within himself, searching.
Will, are you all right?
The voice belonged to Amberlee. He blinked, forcing himself awake.
Will.
She was cradling his head in her lap, her face bent close to his own, her long chestnut hair trailing down about him like a veil.
Amberlee?
He asked sleepily, pushing himself upright. Then he reached for her wordlessly and held her close against him.
I thought I had lost you, he managed. And I you.
She laughed softly, her arms tight about his neck.
You have been sleeping for hours ever since they brought you here.
The veilman nodded into her shoulder, aware suddenly of the pungent smell of incense in the air. He realized it was the incense that was making him feel so groggy. Gently he released the elven girl and looked about. They were enclosed by a windowless cell, black but for a single light that shone from within a glass container suspended from a ceiling chain, another of the lights that burned neither oil nor pitch and gave off no smoke. One wall of the cell was composed entirely of iron bars fastened vertically into the stone of the floor and ceiling. A single door opened through the bars, fastened in place by hinges on one side and a massive key lock on the other. Within the cell had been placed a pitcher of water, an iron basin, towels, blankets, and three straw-filled sleeping mats. On one of the mats lay Eritrea, her breathing deep and even. Beyond the wall of iron bars was a passageway that ran to a set of stairs, then disappeared into blackness. Amberlee followed his gaze to the rover girl.
I think she is all right. Just sleeping. Until now I have not been able to wake either of you. Malinroe, he whispered, remembering. Has she harmed you?
Amberlee shook her head.
She has barely spoken to me. In fact, I did not even know who it was that had taken me prisoner at first. The stick men brought me here, and I slept for a time. Then she came to me. She told me that there were others searching for me, that they would be brought to her as I had been brought. Then she left.
Sea-green eyes sought his own.
She frightens me, Will. She is beautiful, but so cold.
She is a monster. How did she find you in the first place? Amberlee paled.
Something chased me down into the hollows. I never saw it, but I could feel it. Something evil, searching for me.
She paused. I ran for as long as I was able, then I crawled. Finally, I just collapsed. The stick men must have found me and brought me to her.
Will. Was it Malinroe I sensed?
The veilman shook his head. No.
It was the Reaper.
She stared at him wordlessly for a moment, then looked away.
And now it is here in the hollows, isn't it?
He nodded.
The witch knows about it, though. She has gone to look for it.
He smiled grimly.
Maybe they will destroy each other.
She did not smile back.
How did you manage to find me?
He told her then everything that had happened since he had left her concealed in the bushes on the rim of the hollows. The encounter with Eritrea, the deaths of Cephalo and the rovers, the recovery of the elfstones, the flight back through the Wilderun, the meeting with Hebel and Drifter, the journey down into the hollows, the discovery of the stickmen, and the confrontation with Malinroe. He finished by telling her what the witch had done to Hebel.
That poor old man, she whispered, and there were tears in her eyes. He meant no harm to her. Why did she do that to him?
She doesn't care a whit about any of us, the Veilman replied. All that interests her are the Elfstones. She means to have them, Amberley. Hebel was just a convenient example for the rest of us, particularly me. But you won't give them to her, will you? He looked at her uncertainly. If it means saving our lives, I will. We have to get out of here. The elven girl shook her head slowly. I don't think that she will let us go, Will. Not even if you give her what she wants. Not after what you have told me about Hebel. He was silent a moment. I know. But maybe we can bargain with her. She would agree to anything to get the stones. He stopped abruptly, listening. Shh! Someone is coming. They peered wordlessly through the bars of their cell into the darkness of the corridor beyond. There was a slight shuffling sound upon the stairs. Then a figure appeared within the fringe of their single light. It was Wisp. Something to eat, he announced brightly, holding forth a tray with pieces of bread and fruit on it. Shuffling to the cell, he slipped the tray through a narrow slot in the bars at the base of the door. Good food, he told them, turning to leave. Wisp, Will called after him. The furry creature turned, staring at the Veilman quizzically. Can you stay and talk with us? Will asked. The wizened face broke into a grin. Wisp will talk with you. Will glanced at Amberley. The ankle. Can you walk? She nodded. It's much better, she answered him. He took her hand and led her to the tray of food. Wordlessly, they seated themselves. Wisp hunched down on the lowest step of the darkened stairway, his head cocking. Will helped